From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two former correspondents for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, who now star in TV series and are brothers. We meet Rob and Nate Cordry. Rob Cordry stars in the new sitcom The Winner, which premiered on Fox this week. He plays a 32-year-old virgin who still lives at home with his parents. Nate Cordry plays a writer and performer on Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which is set backstage at a network TV sketch comedy show. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by the Italian trumpeter Enrico Rava. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests Rob Corddry and Nate Corddry first became known as correspondents on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Rob was on the show 4 years before leaving last August. His younger brother Nate was on for about 10 months. They each left to work on TV series. Rob's new sitcom, The Winner, premiered on Fox this week. He plays a 32-year-old virgin who still lives at home with his parents. Nate is one of the stars of the NBC series Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which is set backstage at a sketch comedy show like Saturday Night Live. Nate plays a writer and actor on the show. We thought it would be a lot of fun to bring Nate and Rob Corddry together for an interview. Rob Corddry, Nate Corddry, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, for you to both be actors and to have both appeared on the same show and then have series at the same time... You'd have to either get along pretty well or be really competitive. So where do you fall in on that scale?
Get very quiet.
Yeah, we're not competitive yet, but any day now. No, we're not competitive at all.
I think if we were twins or something, or if we had similar looks and did similar work, we have similar sensibilities as actors, but I think a lot of times we're kind of auditioning and trying to work in different areas. So there's a lot of parts of us that are very similar as actors and comedians, but I think there's a lot of parts of ourselves that are very different, where we don't compete with each other. So I think there's some separation, I guess.
That being said, I did read for Nate's part on Studio 60. I did.
That's true.
I did not get it.
And
did you really? That's not a joke?
I really did. I actually made my agent get me an audition, and they wanted nothing to do with me.
Well, for obvious reasons, because you're 6 feet tall, and you know?
And too handsome.
Right. They wanted more of an awkward-looking guy with big ears, so that was... But that was funny. We auditioned the same day, mm-hmm. and you went in at like 11, and I went in at like 2 in the afternoon or something. It was very bizarre.
And you both knew that you were each auditioning.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I called him really late at night, just you know, kind of throw him off, like a 3 a.m. call, and then I called him again at 7 a.m.
Make sure he didn't get any sleep.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
He drugged me.
Yeah.
He slipped me a roofie.
Right.
I was a little dizzy for the interview.
Right.
How do you see your territory as being different as actors?
Well, you know, we both sort of came up in different ways. I started out doing improv and sketch with the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York, and Nate started at Williamstown. So it's two completely different tracks.
Williamstown is...
In Western Massachusetts. Mm-hmm.
It's a regional, it's a summer theater in Western Mass on the campus of Williams College that is a wonderful regional theater that offers a really, like a vast array of training programs for young actors. It won the Tony a couple years ago for best regional theater. And lots of film and TV actors kind of go there in the summer to kind of get away from the business and, you know, tread the boards again, I guess.
And to have sandwiches named after them in a local sub shop.
So, Rob, you
started
off...
The Eric Stoltz is wonderful.
Right. The Ned Beatty. A little hammy, but good.
So, Rob, you started off more in, like, sketch comedy, and Nate, you started more in straight acting.
Yeah, I think that's... Yeah.
Yeah, well, I started off doing really crappy Shakespeare in Manhattan and realized I wasn't very good at it. It was, but I was always playing jackasses, basically. And so I just decided to cut out the middleman and you know,
right,
be a jackass all the time.
We both did this Shakespeare tour, this company that is no longer around, unfortunately. It was called the National Shakespeare Company. Rob did it in
94, 95.
You did the year-long national tour of Hamlet and Twelfth Night. Who did you play?
I played Horatio and Andrew Aguecheek.
Right. And I did the local tour, like, in 2000 when I had moved to New York, and it was the following fall after I'd moved. And I got the audition for... They were doing Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet, and it wasn't the year-long national tour, it was more of a local tour, but we worked with the same company, and there was still a guy that was working there that had worked with both of us, and you were doing The Daily Show, I think, then. That was early when you started.
Now, Nate, did you get on The Daily Show because people got to know you through Rob?
No, I hadn't met anyone there before I auditioned, but they lost Stephen Colbert, obviously, to his show, and then they lost someone else. I forget, but they were casting new correspondents. And Rob was nice enough to go to one of the producers, Ben Carlin, who I think you've spoken to, and said, my brother is auditioning, you should look at his tape. And so they saw a bunch of people in New York, and they saw a bunch of people in Los Angeles, and they saw the tape, and I was lucky enough to get a call back where you had to kind of, you know, you wear the suit and you sit at the desk and actually do a bit with John and follow a teleprompter, which was a terrifying experience. So it certainly didn't hurt, obviously, that that Rob was already working there. But it was also, I think it was dangerous for The Daily Show to cast me, because if it didn't work, it'd make them look really bad. It would make me look really bad as just Rob Corddry's brother, you know, who's only there because Rob's there. And it would look poorly on both of us. So there was a lot of, you know, we were keeping our fingers crossed. Like the show was, and I was, making sure, like hoping that it went off, you know, well. Because if it didn't, it would look really bad. But I think it was a success.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Nate Corddry and Rob Corddry. And Rob Corddry was a correspondent on The Daily Show for about 4 years and now has his own series called The Winner that just premiered on Fox. And Nate Corddry was more briefly on The Daily Show and now is one of the stars of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. Rob, would you describe the type of character you typically played as a correspondent on The Daily Show?
Well, it's interesting because characters on The Daily Show are largely audience defined. When Ed Helms and I first started on The Daily Show, we just imitated Stephen Colbert for a year or two. I guess the audience would pick up certain nuances in our performance, and they started calling me the sort of a frattish boor, and the writers started writing me that way. And so I always liked to play it as we're all stupid. That's the secret to playing a Daily Show correspondent, is that you're dumb. But my character had the advantage of knowing he was dumb and didn't care.
Which is very funny.
And is that something that you figured out after you started doing it, like through the kind of feedback you were getting? Is that a direction you consciously headed in?
It's a lot easier to interview these people if you have this exaggerated, unearned confidence. And even when you, especially when you know that you're dumb and you still think you're better than they are.
Well, you've interviewed a lot of people where it's hard to tell, like, what did they know in advance, particularly earlier in your appearances on The Daily Show before it became quite the phenomenon that it did. Did they know
before I made it the show it was? Right.
Did they know what was going on? Were they in on the joke? Did they know there was going to be a joke?
When I first started, there were researchers and associate producers who would book the interviews there who would still say we're with Comedy Central's news program. That is no longer possible, especially after the 2004 elections, or running up to the 2004 elections when the show really gained popularity. You know, I never interviewed someone that didn't know what the show was or had a very close loved one who knew what the show was and would warn them about it. Mm-hmm. So I would start every interview by saying, look, you know the show. You know we're a comedy show. But I'm really going to ask you about, you know, your opinions or your passions, whatever you're here for. I want you to speak about it seriously. If I tell you the sky is green, please correct me and say the sky is blue. Don't try and follow my logic, because we're looking for straight answers. And unfortunately, I'm the jackass here. And a lot of times people would try and be funny, and we'd have to sort of steer them away from that. And even at times we'd have to say, look, I think you're a very funny guy, but none of this is going to make it on the air. Please just answer my question. Why do you hate gays? You know, or something like
that. So what are some of the responses that surprised you the most?
Oh, God. I had one guy, well, speaking of hating gays, I was speaking to probably the most homophobic person I've ever met in my life. But he told me that he worked for some family council in Philadelphia, and he said that he loved gay people, and not only that, he, if they were drowning, put him in a sea of gay people, and he would breathe life into their mouths.
Oh my God.
And we murdered this guy. We murdered him. And he called me up the next day and asked me out to lunch. He loved the piece so much.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, in addition to your interviews, of course, you did a lot of, like, stand-up reports where you'd, like, you know, talk with Jon Stewart and, you know, report on something. In fact, I want to play one. And this is one that you did shortly after President Bush announced that there would be some kind of investigation into charges, you know, allegations that there was price fixing and other problems in the oil industry. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
I don't remember it.
Well, a profound
I spent most of my time there drunk. I am a functional alcoholic, barely.
Okay, well, this is very funny, so let's hear it.
For more on Bush's aggressive new stance against the oil companies, we turn to our senior petroleum analyst, Rob Corddry. Rob, the President of the United States didn't just talk tough today, Rob. The President didn't just talk tough. He also announced that he was taking this initiative. Take a look.
I'm also directing the Department of Justice to work with the FTC and the Energy Department to conduct inquiries into illegal manipulation or cheating related to the current gasoline prices.
He announced a query into the inner workings of the oil industry, a probe, if you will. Tell us, Rob, what will this investigation entail?
Well, for certain, it will be a long, arduous process. John, here's my guess as to how it might proceed. Now, this is the Oval Office right here. The president plans to leave it. Walk down this hallway to the vice president's office.
Now, let me ask you a question, Rob. What are those black markings, if I may, what do those black X's represent?
Oh, those are the oil executives who maintain a 24-hour presence in Cheney's office. Anyway, John, the president will then begin the probe by saying to the oil executives, hey, Dave, Lee, how you doing? Good to see you, Jimbo. You guys been a price fixin'? And if the answer is yes, the president will take the appropriate action.
Which would be
classified.
That was Rob Corddry with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Rob, did you start watching the news differently after you started doing The Daily Show?
Oh, yeah. I started watching the news a lot more, too. I actually became addicted to it in a way. I was watching like two C-SPANs at once, you know. And I can't help. I think I've sort of been. You can't help but watch the news differently, and you know, in the obvious way, just with that Daily Show sort of slant,
which is in part looking at how news reporters and anchors carry themselves on TV.
That's my favorite part about The Daily Show is making fun of the news people themselves and the trappings of a news organization, you know, like Fox and CNN and MSNBC. You know, that was my right down to the chyrons or the news alerts. You know, I mean, that's some of my favorite most satirizable, I just made that word up, aspects of the news.
My guests are Rob and Nate Corddry, former correspondents for The Daily Show, who now star in TV series. Rob stars in the new Fox sitcom, The Winner. Nate is in the NBC series, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Nate and Rob Corddry. They're brothers. They were both on The Daily Show, Rob for over 4 years, and Nate for how long, Nate?
About 10 months or so.
And now they're each in series. Rob is on the new series, The Winner, on Fox, and Nate is on Studio 60 on NBC. Nate, you did a really funny story on The Daily Show after Cheney shot his friend in that hunting accident. And this one's a real classic. So, and by that I mean we played it once before on our show.
Yes, and I was driving my car in Los Angeles, listening to you, and Ben Carlin, who you were interviewing, said, "This is a piece from Nate Cordray." And you said, "Nate Cordray," and almost drove my car off the road because I couldn't believe that I was on Fresh Air.
Well, I want to play it now, even though we've heard it once on Fresh Air, because it's such an interesting piece. So this is the piece you did after Cheney shot his friend in the hunting accident. And you went to a hunting farm,
preserve,
so to speak. Hunting preserve.
Is what they call them. Yeah.
That's operated in a very similar way to the way that the place where Cheney was hunting operates.
Right.
And before we hear it, I want you to describe how this operation works.
You show up and order your kill, basically. They have hunting preserves for birds. So you go onto this, you go into a controlled area, like a field, and then they release the animal in front of you, and then you shoot them. So everything about what's great about hunting, I think there are great aspects about hunting. I appreciate what it is. I've never hunted myself, but I understand why people love it. All of that is taken out of it. all of that is removed. So you just step up and you order your birds, and they give you the guns, and they drive you out to the field, and you kill them.
Well, let's hear the piece. And this is Nate Cordray.
When the vice president went on a private hunting trip last month, he took a lot of heat for shooting his friend. But the truth is, he's actually a crack shot, who's downed as many as 70 pheasant in a single day. And he's done it on canned hunts, where birds are raised to be shot. I wanted to hunt pheasant like the vice president, so I made a reservation at the Tobacco Stick Hunting Preserve in North Carolina.
We release birds per order of the customer, and the customer is able to go to the field and hunt for these birds.
It's like regular hunting, but with a menu.
Quail are $7 each.
Okay.
The chucker is $13 each. The pheasant is $16. And we use pointing dogs for $75 each.
Can I shoot the dog?
That'd be a very serious issue to shoot the dog.
So I can't shoot?
Can't shoot the dog.
I was pretty sure that the vice president would get to shoot the dog, but 140 pheasant would have to quench my bird lust. But would my $1,000 ensure this was better than regular hunting?
Well, here, the birds are in the field for you. You know they're there. It's a sure thing. The birds are here. On a wild bird hunt, you may find birds and you may not find birds.
And who really has time to hunt and track prey anymore?
It's a sure thing.
One thing I've always hated about hunting, it's the challenge.
All I needed now was a shooting thingy.
This is the gun you'll be using?
I'll be using this gun right here?
Yes, you will.
May I?
Yes.
Wow. So for unlimited ammo, do I hit up, down, left, right, A, B, A, B, select, start?
No, you just...
I have to reload.
Yeah, after three shots, you reload again. It's bam, bam, bam.
Finally, the hunt was on. We tracked our prey to this barn, where they were hiding in a quail cage. I made my move.
Here we go. I want that guy right there. And this guy. And this bitch in the corner. And her friend. These two, I want them in a pair.
The birds were placed in a sealed laundry basket. God forbid they get away and we'd have to spend all day hunting them down. We drove our prey to the hunting site. Let's just say it was an awkward ride. At long last, the hunt was on.
And that was Nate Cordray on The Daily Show doing a sketch after the vice president shot his friend in a hunting accident. Was it awkward to basically be doing a sketch with real people. I mean, it's a kind of Borat type of thing where, you know, you're right. in character, but everybody else is being real. And it's like their hunting preserve that you're mocking.
Yes. He actually, but he got his due. He actually, the guy at the end of the day, he went to my producer, Stu Miller, at the very end. We had to pay for the guides and the birds. So we were writing him a check for all of it, and it was something like $300 or $400, and he's like, $1,000. And we're like, I'm sorry. He's like, I'm not signing this release until I get $1,000. So he was very savvy. He knew exactly what was going on. But to be one of the hardest ones was being with the gun, with the guy who was the guide, who was teaching me how to shoot the gun. I don't know if he owned a television. He might be the only guy left in America who doesn't know what The Daily Show was. And that was really hard. It's hard. It's hard to do. It's not easy to lure them into your cage and, you know, and mock them in a way. But it's also, we're not mocking them personally. We're also mocking, you know, the kind of their, I don't know, their the world that they live in, I guess.
I was mocking them personally.
Right. Again.
Absolutely.
How we differ.
Rob and Nate Cordry are former correspondents for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Rob now stars in the new Fox sitcom The Winner. Nate is on NBC's Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. The Cordry brothers will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Power of a Positive No, How to Say No and Still Get to Yes, by William Ury, author of Getting Past No. From the Joyce Foundation, supporting efforts to educate America's workforce and improve the quality of teaching in low-achieving schools, joycefdn.org. And from ThinkMap, maker of the Visual Thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Rob Cordry talks about his new sitcom, The Winner. Nate Cordry talks about his role on Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. And they each talk about the incredibly bad luck surrounding TV commercials they made earlier in their careers. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD from the Italian trumpeter Enrico Rava. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with brothers Rob and Nate Cordry. They're both former correspondents for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Rob was on the show for about 4 years, Nate for less than a year. They each left The Daily Show when they landed roles in TV series. Well, you each are in series now, so I want to talk with you about your series, starting with you, Rob, because yours is brand new. It just started on Fox. It's called The Winner. Tell us what the premise is.
Oh, it's about it's narrated from the present. The richest man in Buffalo tells us the story of the days he spent in 1994. He's an OCD guy who never leaves the house, and the woman of his dreams comes back into town, and he tries to gain life experience in order to be worthy of her. Wait, now, if I had pitched it like that, I would have gotten kicked out the door. But it's really not a bad premise.
Well, the pitch, of course, would have to include that he's 32 and still a virgin.
He's 32, he's still a virgin, and has never held a job and lives with his parents.
And his best friend becomes the woman who he knew from childhood, who he always had a crush on. Her 14-year-old son becomes his kind of partner in crime because they're both commiserating about how to make it with girls. Except, you know, one of them's 14 and you're 32, so it's kind of sad and tragic.
Yeah, well, spiritually, my character is 14 and emotionally. Mm-hmm. So we really just sort of we're having the same experience. And he's actually probably a little bit more advanced than my character. This arc that we shot 6 episodes, and this arc is sort of about Glenn finally losing his virginity. I imagine if we get the chance to do more, we'll tackle other things. So it's not all about doing it.
Do you have a favorite scene from the 6 that you've shot so far?
Well, I, you know what? I love the scene where I think the first episode really kicks in when I see Allison for the first time since I was 14, and for me it was yesterday, and for her, you know, she barely remembers anything. So, that sort of our reunion is probably my favorite scene.
Well, let's hear it.
You look radiant.
What? Who are you? Why are you in my... Oh, my God. Glenn Abbott? Glenn Abbott? Wow. Oh, you look good.
I just got my hair done.
Oh.
No, get it? I said that to you. At the game, remember? October 11th, 1976. So what brings you back?
Well, actually, my mother's sick.
That's so great. That you're going to take care of her. Yeah. And we're going to be neighbors again.
You still live at home?
Yeah, just on weekdays. Or some weekends.
That's Rob Corddry and Aaron Hayes in a scene from Rob Corddry's new sitcom on Fox, which is called The Winner. You were recently on Fox News promoting your new show, The Winner, and you said something really, really, really funny that was actually excerpted on The Daily Show afterwards. You were on Fox News with the news crawl going by, and it kind of like, what did you... I want you to describe what you said.
I said that the crawl was chafing my nipples because you know the crawl is nipple height,
right?
The crawl is something that, you know, I was speaking earlier about how it's the trappings of those news shows that I hate. The crawl is probably I hate that more than anything because you're getting about 48 hours of news. And there really isn't even 24 to fill those networks, so I really resent them and what they did to my nipples, because that's true. That's a physical thing crawling across the table.
You must have known you were going to say that before.
Yes.
You...
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It was actually suggested to me. I called when I found out I was going to be on Fox News. I called a couple guys at The Daily Show, Tim Carvel and Jim Margolis, and I said, you got to help me here. They want me to talk about Anna Nicole.
Oh my God!
And well, I forget what else. I blocked it. Oh, Barack Obama quitting smoking. And they gave me a bunch of talking points. I wasn't really prepared for it, so I had to get some help from those guys. And I believe we were sort of riffing on a bunch of different crawl jokes. And God, I don't remember whether it was Tim or Jim that gave me that one. I'm going to err on the side of Tim. He's more of a nipples guy than Jim is.
What was the reaction of the woman who was interviewing you at the time? Because I have to say, most guests on Fox News don't talk about their nipples.
Well, I was on Good Day New York earlier. No, I'm sorry. I was on Fox's morning show earlier, and I said pubic hair. Before 9 a.m. So I was sort of on a roll that day anyway. But the woman, actually, her response was to throw, to transition right to the Columbine bomb scare, which was inelegant at best.
So did you get a lot of response to that?
Apparently at The Daily Show, and I'm glad I didn't know this before, when any alumni is ever on TV, they will say it over the PA. So obviously somebody announced that Rob Corddry was going to be on Fox News and everybody watched. That's what John latched onto apparently. And he said that, once they threw to Columbine, he said, I think we have the opening to the show. And also, he also pointed out that Fox had written a chyron under me that said, Rob Corddry, and then it said, his best friend is a 14-year-old boy. Just like, that's that brilliant Fox, like, subtle undermining, you know? It's so brilliant. Like, the guy that wrote that, comic genius.
Right.
And John also pointed that out on the air.
My guests are Rob and Nate Corddry, former correspondents for The Daily Show, who now act in TV series. Rob stars in The Winner. Nate's in Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Rob and Nate Corddry, two brothers who are former correspondents for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and now are in TV series. Rob stars in the new Fox series, The Winner. Nate, you're in a relatively new series, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which is a behind-the-scenes at a sketch comedy, at a network TV sketch comedy show, i.e. kind of like Saturday Night Live.
Right.
It's written and produced by Aaron Sorkin, who also did The West Wing and Sports Night. And he writes these, like, hyper-verbal characters.
Yes.
What are the scripts like when you get them? I mean, they're, because they are so hyper-verbal.
They're very thick. they usually don't change. There are very little changes to when he writes. He writes the script usually by act. We'll get, a teaser and an act one, and there are four acts in the show. And then we'll get an act two and an act three and act four. So he writes by acts. He doesn't write the entire thing consecutively in one day, in one sitting. He kind of splits it up. So he and the team of writers kind of combine. And there are very few changes. Once he basically writes it, unless there's a major change, like an actor can't be there or there's a casting change or something didn't clear the censors, that script remains. Which I think is unusual. I think a lot of times, a lot of writers are so hands-on. They're on set all the time, changing little words here and there. And he's not. He's very confident in what he writes, and he doesn't. There's not a lot of editing that goes on.
I want to play a scene from Studio 60, and this is a scene from one of the early episodes in which your parents have come to visit. And your parents are from the Midwest. They don't really keep up with popular culture. They don't really watch television. They're not very excited by the fact that you're a writer and actor on this really popular sketch comedy show. And you're giving them a tour of the theater, I think kind of trying to impress them with the history here. So here's the scene.
It was a movie theater until November 30th, 1941, exactly 1 week before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. That's when a fledgling network of radio stations called the National Broadcasting System, in an effort to compete with its older and better established cousins, CBS and NBC, bought the Addison, gutted it, keeping all the original architecture and Art Deco fixtures, and turned it into a broadcast studio for radio plays. The most famous of these was a Sunday night series called the Studio 60 Theater of the Air. After the war, radio gave way to television. The first show here was called the MBS Philco Comedy Hour, which no one's ever heard of because it had the misfortune of being programmed first against the Colgate Comedy Hour and then the Texaco Star Theater. Then it was canceled after its cast and writing staff were decimated by the blacklist. In 1959, NBS renamed the theater in honor of its most famous tenant, and the Addison became Studio 60.
You got a question?
Yeah.
When did you become an interior decorator?
Dad.
Art Deco fixtures.
I'm just telling you a story, Dad. I'm trying to take your mind off of it. That's what I do.
Okay, I'd want you two to fight. Tommy, tell us how you put the skits together.
We don't do skits, Mom. A skit's the one the football players dress up as the cheerleaders and think it's wit. Sketches are when some of the best minds in comedy come together and put on a national television show that's watched and talked about by millions of people.
Don't you talk to your mother like that.
I'm trying to tell you, you're standing in the middle of the Paris Opera House of American television.
Well, that's swell, Tom, but your little brother is standing in the middle of Afghanistan.
Did you know before the scene that you had a brother who was in Afghanistan and that
nope no it's so bizarre. Like with a play, there's two acts and it's the play and it's written, unless it's a new play and you're changing things, but that's it. You have the given circumstances and you know your character's background. You have it's set. There's nothing to change and you have that to work with, but with this medium, and the same with film, With series television, it's constantly changing. So tomorrow, I could find out, you know, that
you've been blind.
Yeah, that I'm actually blind. so that was so you never know, and then you take. But it's written so well, it's not jarring. He knows the characters really well. He knows all of us, all of the characters really well. So he knows what fits and what doesn't. When I read that script, it was the fifth or sixth episode, and the script fell out of my hand. I mean, I was so moved by it and so excited that, I mean, he has a lot of mouths to feed, I guess, on that show. There's a lot of people ahead of me in line, you know, for storylines or whatever. But I was honored that he'd give me something as cool and as meaty as that. And actually, in the next couple episodes of Studio 60, there's a lot more of that stuff. So it's it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to play, but my God, it was like a page of dialogue without a break.
Yeah, I called Nate right after that ran, and I said, "How did you do that?"
And it was a steady cam too, so there's no editing. I had to get it all in that one take, which was brutal.
That's terrible.
Brutal, but a lot of fun. A lot of fun to do, and the actors who play my parents were great. So that was a lot of fun to shoot.
Must be odd to meet your parents after you've already shot some episodes. After you've already gotten a sense of who your character is,
yeah,
then you meet your parents.
Then I meet who the casting people thought could pass as my parents, which was kind of hilarious.
Yeah,
and I actually ended up giving my real parents, our real parents, came out to Los Angeles a month or so later in separate trips, but I gave them the same tour. I gave them the tour, and I remember walking down that hallway in the second floor of the on the soundstage and going, "My God, Dad, this is really bizarre." Mm. And that was before the episode aired. I'm like, I'm expecting you to turn to me and tell me that Rob is in a cave in Afghanistan right now.
I hope your parents were more impressed than your characters.
They were. They're actually, that's what I tell people when they mention that episode, is that they say, I tell them that my parents or our parents are probably they're maybe too supportive, you know.
Yeah.
They've always been unbelievably supportive, and our sister as well. They are big supporters of ours. Even back when Rob was handing out flyers on, you know, on the corner of the street for a gig in New York.
Minipito's Mexican restaurant on 58th Street.
Are you both on pins and needles now, not being sure of the future of the shows? You know, because the winner is new, so. So, Rob, I'm sure you're not sure yet whether it's going to be renewed past the first six episodes. And Studio 60 is on a hiatus now. I don't know if you're certain whether it's coming back or not. So, are you living with uncertainty now?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all part of, I guess, of like the, you know, move to LA, be on a TV show experience. Yeah, who knows? And it's a shame that we have to sort of, at this point, it's sad that we're rooting for another show's failure for Studio 60 to make it on, which sucks, and it's a shame, but I there's no way that I could, you know. People are asking me if I watch The Black Donnellys, which is this show that's on Monday nights that took over for us for a couple weeks. I'm like, there's no way I can watch that show. You know, free of, I can't just not judge that show.
Nate, it's amazing.
No,
it's amazing.
No, Yeah, certainly. I mean, we start shooting actually again tomorrow for the remainder, the last four episodes. So we're going to shoot the whole season, and they'll be on the air eventually. But you know, whether we come back, it's very much up in the air. But you know, we wait and see.
And Reb, what about you?
Well, I'm just recently newly on Pins and Needles because you know we just premiered and we got the numbers back, which is an impenetrable mathematical equation, and I still really haven't gotten a straight answer on whether we did well or not. I have no idea. I just really, really, really enjoy doing this show, and I want to keep doing it.
Now, you both did some commercials before The Daily Show and before getting series on television. I want you to each describe a commercial that you did that you found kind of amusing for all the right or wrong reasons.
Great question. That is a great question. You go first,
okay.
Al.
I was in a commercial with my friend Carrot Top. His friends call him Scott. Fascinating. It was one of those 1-800 call ATT commercials. I'd also just like to say, dial down the center. People, it can't be easier than that. Dial down the center. Free for you, cheap for them, or something. The commercial. What's funny about the commercial is that I'm a tour guide on a bus, on a double decker tour bus in New York City, and Carrot Top commandeers the bus and describes the virtues of dialing down the center. And the commercial was pulled after 9/11 because he commandeered a bus.
Oh.
Yes, the terrorists beat Carrot Top. They are stronger. They're stronger than the power of the top.
Nate, what's one of your commercials you want to describe?
It's hard to top, but I did actually. I single-handedly brought down two major corporations.
That's true.
I did a spot which was a really great spot that Errol Morris directed. It was so cool. It was a really amazing day. Errol Morris is this really great, you know, documentary filmmaker, Oscar winner. and it was for, this is in 2000, I forget when it was. It was one of my first commercials, and it was for Anderson Consulting. and if you remember, Anderson Consulting did the books for Enron. So we shot these ads, and it was like this huge ad campaign. It was huge. It was going to be international. I was going to buy a boat with this money. And sure enough, you know, I'm reading the Times and front page, Enron, Anderson Consulting, you know, indicted, all this stuff. So the spots were pulled, obviously. and then like a couple of years later, I did this. If you're in the commercial business, a great ads to get are for drug companies because they have unlimited resources. So they run your ads like crazy. So you can make a lot of money in residuals. And I booked one and I was so excited. And I'm like, oh, it's going to run forever. And I was going to buy another boat. And it was for Merck, and sure enough, it was Vioxx. And that ad never made it to air either. So I've had two close calls. I still don't own a boat. But yeah, those were two very sad days.
Did you have any that got on?
I did. I had Xbox, a really funny Xbox commercial. I had a bunch of commercials for Verizon and Dunkin' Donuts. Some of them air, some of them don't. But I was very lucky commercially for a while. If you're one of those actors in New York or LA who can work commercially and survive and not have to wait tables, you can earn a terrific living. There's a lot of actors that do that are just kind of straight commercial actors that make a lot of money in it. So I was very lucky.
Well, it's really been fun to talk with you both. So I wish you good luck with your shows and with everything else. And thank you so much for coming on Fresh Air. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Rob and Nate Cordry are former correspondents for The Daily Show. Rob now stars in the new Fox TV sitcom The Winner. Nate is in NBC's Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which is currently on hiatus. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by the trumpeter Enrico Rava, one of Italy's best-known musicians. This is Fresh Air. Trumpeter Enrico Rava is one of Italy's best-known and most recorded jazz musicians, and a true internationalist, working with players from all around Western Europe, as well as Americans like saxophonist Steve Lacy, composer Carla Bley, and trombonist Roswell Rudd. In the 1970s, Rava recorded some memorable records for the ECM label. Now he's back with the company. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's a happy homecoming.
Russ Freeman's tune, The Wind, popularized by Chet Baker and later covered by Mariah Carey. It's from trumpeter Enrico Rava's CD, The Words and the Days, on ECM. That label bathes most every record in a wet wash of studio reverb, which doesn't always help. But that big echo does enhance Rava's warm sound and spacious phrasing, makes him sound fuller and more imposing. His new album mixes ECM's patented unhurried lyricism with a few changes of pace, like Echoes of Duke, Rava's angular revamp of Ellington's loping Echoes of Harlem. For 10 years now, Enrico Rava's sidekick and foil in his Italian quintet is trombonist Gianluca Petrella. He put out a nice record of his own on Blue Note last year. Where Rava wisely concentrates on his ravishing sound in the trumpet's middle register, making a virtue of his limited range a la Chet Baker, the trombonist is a wide-roaming virtuoso. Petrella often plays notes or whole lines on trombone, voiced above the smaller trumpet, for an unusual upside-down blend. It's an idea they may have borrowed from Ellington. That's lovely, and sounds all the more effective contrasted with the livelier stuff. Happily, the trumpeter and trombonist mesh just as well when they improvise rings around each other as when they drawl out a pretty tune. On drummer Roberto Gatto's Traps, Rava steps into the improvise section, like he's channeling the Art Ensemble of Chicago's late trumpeter Lester Bowie. Thank you. 30 years ago, Enrico Rava made some terrific records alongside the gloriously expressive trombonist Roswell Rudd. To have found a second perfect partner in Gianluca Petrella is almost too much good luck to hope for. It's like finding true love twice in a lifetime.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed The Words and the Days, the new CD by the Enrico Rava Quintet on the ECM label. You can now download podcasts of Fresh Air on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Patti Smith and the band R.E.M. will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Monday. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Smith and Michael Stipe. Join us for the next Fresh Air.